Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In order for America to meet the challenge of a world struggling for resources, oil, and power, our best plan may be to invent our way into energy efficiency. But invention isn't enough. These innovations need to find their place in the new energy mix. In just a moment, we talk with a former Department of Energy official who worked directly under Bill Richardson about what science and business can do when they put their minds together. Stay tuned. Every day, we hear about the prospects of energy independence. We generally talk about wind and solar, geothermal and biofuels and the like as the viable alternatives. But the moment you really look at any of these, you'll find that each of these technologies is a complex assemblage of every kind of more elegant technology. So where's the innovation coming from? Business plays a large role, but so do our universities. Today, we explore what Rice University in Houston, Texas, is doing under the direction of very informed and experienced leadership. Right now, we're talking about adding some economic stimulus to our economy here. $150 billion incentive may be in the mailbox relatively soon because we need it. One of the reasons that we're being forced into this position is because so much of our economy is now focused on supporting the high cost of energy in everything that we do. Sustainability, energy independence is on the table for lots and lots of people. It's something that people are very comfortable talking about. Our politicians are talking about it, actually of both parties. And so in order to accomplish that, it's going to take a lot of new technologies, a lot of people thinking about what can be done, experimenting with that, and bringing it all to market. And someone who's directly involved in virtually all of those arenas is our guest right now, Emil Pena, who is talking to us now from Houston, Texas. He's the new executive director of the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute of Rice University. Mr. Pena, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you, Sid.
You have quite an interesting background. You've been involved with energy issues for quite some time. Why don't you give us a little history of what you've been doing for much of your life?
I'm a native Texan, and I came out of University of Texas. I've been involved in energy my whole professional career. I started out in pipeline, the mid-region here in Texas, in the natural gas pipeline area. And I also worked for Atlantic Richfield for a number of years. That was an integrated oil and gas company, and we really were in everything into refining as well as exploration and production. As of late, in 2000, I served in the Clinton administration under Secretary Bill Richardson in the Energy Department, where I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Oil and Gas. And there, I managed the fossil fuels program pertaining to oil and gas and technologies. And we produced a lot of good products for the country and adding more production to the U.S., and particularly looking at the ultra-deep waters in offshore technologies. Recently, I've been working in the refining technologies pretty successfully, looking at heavy crudes and how we can actually produce more gasoline, diesel, and jet fuels out of the heavier and heavier crude that are being produced globally. And again, being appointed, as you pointed out, to the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute at Rice is a pretty big job, and we look at a variety of different research areas, not only the upstream, but also the midstream and transportation technologies, as well as the downstream in refining there at Rice. Rice has a very fine history of doing research as a research institute here in Houston in this area. But we also have a very fine, very good history of commercialization as well, not only for our technologies that we research in the university, but also other technologies that come in to our Rice Alliance program. So there are several institutes that are in existence there at Rice, covering everything from IT to energy, and also the Baker Institute is one of the premier public policy institutes in the country. So quite a bit going on, and certainly in the alternative energy areas, there's quite a bit happening as well.
1999, as you looked at energy futures in America, was where we are now sort of on the table? How was this being viewed? Were people in positions of power and decision makers at that point conscious of the fact that we could get to this point so soon?
Very much so, Sid. I had been looking at, you know, production trends and so forth through Energy Information Administration, the EIA, which is our agency that looks at projections and numbers, production numbers, and the IEA, the International Energy Agency out of Europe, and they have their own projections. And I had been looking at the different trends, and certainly President Clinton and Secretary Richardson were very much aware of how important domestic production is here in the United States to, you know, not be so dependent. I think we're always going to have some dependence on foreign crude and fossil fuels some way, somehow, whether it's LNG or crude oil, so forth, that are now being imported. But we can certainly blunt the foreign control and wrest more control with our destiny using our own production. Onshore production has been on the decline for the last couple of decades, and even at flat out drilling for oil and gas here onshore, you're basically just stemming the decline curve to a flat line. You're not increasing production that's needed, you know, using onshore production. And the big hits are really coming out of Alaska, which is very political, again, and it's going to take a long time to get online because of just the transportation issues down from that part of the world through Canada or through Alaska. And so really the big hits are going to be in the ultra-deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico. And those are very, very strategic production areas. And again, what it depends on primarily are the technologies on how to extract, how to produce those that oil and gas from the Gulf of Mexico. And the challenges for production are immense. There are probably greater challenges of production from the deep Gulf. Now, those are incremental fields, you know, that once we put them on, those do stem our decline curves and add to our production domestically. But the challenges, again, are greater than those that we faced going to the moon. So because of the different atmospheric changes that we go through and through the water columns and so forth. So I think that was one of our main and key focuses when I was at DOE, and we did see how important, how relevant this was domestically for us. And also for the Clinton as well as the current Bush administration, alternative energy has been something that we know that helps on the marginal areas of, again, our energy production, whether it's biofuels or solar or wind, that those technologies, and even nuclear, have to play a role in our energy independence. And it's all about control. And I was asked a couple of weeks ago about $100 barrel oil and what that means or what that'll mean to the United States. Being an American, we're very innovative people, very creative, and we're going to work our way through this. It's just how we do it. And I believe we're going to become very efficient at how we use energy, and we're also going to become very educated about energy. Our energy IQ is pretty low in this country, and a lot of people just don't understand where gasoline comes from after you pump it out of the service station and how that supply works. And also people just don't understand when you flip a light switch, you know, where your power is coming from either. So I think that pretty rapidly we're going to, you know, up our energy IQ, and we're going to, you know, up our efficiency as well. And that's probably the biggest thing that we can do to help ourselves is become more efficient. And then after that, everything comes into view. And again, what we looked at the previous administration was, you know, what impacts the production of heavier crudes we're going to have into our system. And that's what really frightens me, is that the next shoe to drop after these high prices is going to be supply of refined product. That's very important. It's supply of refined product.
Help us understand that a little bit more.
It's very simple. In that today, there's a production of crude that's about 85 million barrels of crude production globally, you know, give or take 100,000 barrels every day. The refining capacity is about 85 million barrels of refining capacity a day. So So we're at a very sharp edge, again, give or take, depending on which refinery is down for maintenance or whatever globally. You know, we're at this very fine line of balance between production and refining. At the same time, most refineries are only capable of refining these lighter-end crudes, the sweeter crudes, and all the time those are dwindling and we're producing more and more heavier crudes, the higher API numbered crudes, and they have a harder time refining those because of the processes that we have today. So I just know that eventually, since no refineries, that's a huge investiture of money is creating new refineries, especially here in the United States domestically, with a lot of different challenges, a lot of different ways, and putting a new refinery online. Our demand is increasing globally. China and India are the two countries that everybody refers to now because those economies are coming into their own, and the demand is going to be there. So it's not like the 70s when we had an oil crisis where it eventually all tapered off because production finally caught up with our demand. Globally, now there's some new players on the scene, and so the demand's always going to stay high from now on. Now, again, the production of this refined product, I think, is going to be the next area that we're really going to have to be cautious about. And again, I see technologies as being the answer. There's different ways to hydrogenate crude oil to make it more refinable, and that's I guess that's my word for it, where we get more of the refined products that we need using these new technology methods rather than the ones that are currently being used by the refiners.
Well, this is an area that I don't hear much discussion about, and I appreciate your perspective on this. If I think about it, it makes perfect sense. You know, every once in a while, a refinery, a major refinery, will go down, and the price of oil universally in the United States goes up. So this relationship of refinery production and prices, we're intimately tied to that. And so in terms of modifying and adapting our refineries to these heavier crudes, which are going to be coming online ever more frequently and in a greater percentage, is that being addressed?
I think that slowly but surely, I think the refiners are starting to realize that you know, even the blending of the heavier and lighter crudes, when they come together, you still have all the heavy metals and sulfur and in suspension, and the refineries are only capable of handling those so far, and then the refinery goes down for maintenance at a particular point. So I think they are starting to realize that, and globally, again, the real sharp visionaries, I guess, in our industry today are saying we do have to modify these things to adapt to these heavier crudes.
So at this point, we're taking the sweet crude. We're taking the cream off the top, and we're running into these crises. Do you have a concept how that might alter the amount of available oil that may be available into the future here? Does it change the equation?
Sure does. Our government predicts that there's actually more pockets of these heavier crudes globally, but then are they producible, and then are they, you know, once you extract them, putting those types of numbers to it, can, you know, are they able to be refined? And so it goes back down to the fact that can we use our technologies to our best effort here, and at $100 a barrel, it makes it very economical to look at hydrogen to make this heavy crude more refinable. You know, the mixing process with hydrogen and heavy crudes, I guess chemically, you elongate the molecule of carbon rather than looking like a buckyball. It becomes longer, and then you emulsify it, and you get more of the refined product that you need, mm-hmm. like jet fuel, diesel, gasoline, and you add more of that rather than toluene, benzene, nonene, and petroleum coke, which has very low value because the BTU content is extremely low on petroleum coke. So it just makes it more efficient to utilize it that way.
We're getting it probably deeper than most people are interested in following, but it's important. And these are the things that people, as you say, our energy IQ is fairly
limited,
right. And these are the questions and issues that we really need to become educated about. And I appreciate your knowledge about this. We'll kind of move forward here. So therefore, as we look into the future, How are we proceeding towards, because people are talking about energy independence. Some people are saying by 2020, some by, you know, other things. It has many, many definitions in terms of what that actually means. What does it mean to you? And if you were to take some steps right now, what do you think are some of the most important first steps right now that, America needs to be addressing?
Well, again, efficient is the key word. You know, we have to become more adept at using our energy wisely. Being from Texas, you know, we've got to look at SUVs and, you know, big pickups a little bit differently than we have in the past.
Oh, darn, huh?
Yeah, well, that's just the way it goes. I think that's primarily one of the areas that we have to look at. But then also investing in our technology is something that we have to have more emphasis on.
Give us an example of how you would recommend increasing efficiencies. Which sectors are you talking about?
Well, certainly the transportation sector is one of them, but when it comes down to the environmental efforts, making more efficient buildings, building more efficient buildings becomes critical as well. I saw a study 2 weeks ago that said that our buildings were so inefficient that if we really looked at the technologies that were available today, we could lower greenhouse gas emissions from our buildings, said, by 60% if we were adjusting, you know, the way we efficiently built our structures.
Briefly talk about some of the technologies that you're referring to in terms of changes in buildings.
The building technologies are windows, heating, air conditioning systems that we put into them. At Rice, we're looking at different ways to cure concrete and so forth. I mean, there's just a lot of different ways that we can become more efficient in the way that we build our structures.
Mm-hmm. So, how about sort of midterm? What should we see in 5 years? Where should we be? Where would you like to be?
This is something that I've worked closely with the Rice Alliance on, mm-hmm. is putting together a platform to create a new marketplace for our greenhouse gas technologies,
mm-hmm.
and other environmental emissions technologies, if you will. Those are actually profit centers. They're not cost centers if you really utilize them properly in capturing greenhouse gas emissions. So over the next 5 years, I would think that just for arresting not only carbon but other methane emissions, that we can utilize these technologies and actually make money capturing methane, for example, that has twice the BTU value of natural gas, and selling it back into the pipeline. But today, globally, it's sad to say that because of the rush to produce more oil and gas, there are more oil and gas flares today than ever before. That's just flaring right into the atmosphere, mm-hmm. which I think is almost a sin at this point.
In terms of long term, how do you see this moving out into the future? How could we advance sustainability?
Technologically, by looking at the different solar technologies that are there, the different wind technologies. Of course, I'm smack dab in the middle of the wind capital of the United States, which is Texas. Our land commissioner here has been very aggressive in changing policy to allow these, you know, wind farms to exist, for example, and the same goes for solar. The federal government, my former agency, the Department of Energy, has been very good about establishing the different centers to study how to more effectively utilize our technologies and our materials to test wind blades and the solar panels and so forth. And we've got a new center here in the Gulf Coast to actually do that. But they're around the country. It's just not in Texas. So we've got quite an effort going on in this area. So that's in my opinion, the future. Nuclear certainly is another technology that we're revisiting as far as how we efficiently build those in a standard way other than a one-off way, which we have in the past, which was very inefficient.
Utilizing more the French model?
Sure. I mean, I think that I've been to France numerous times and see how well they've done with their nuclear capabilities. And that's because they standardized. And
right.
It just makes sense. I mean, for safety reasons, for maintenance reasons, it all seems to come down to, you know, if you do them out of a cookie cutter, then all your parts seem to fit and the engineers know what to look for.
Getting online with nuclear, that's one of the biggest issues because it takes about 10 years to put one online.
Absolutely.
And so, therefore, obviously, if things are more standardized, that process, I'm sure, could be shortened dramatically.
All of these things that have got to be in the mix. Mm-hmm. I think they become more and more relevant. But you've got to start today. Even these refining changes that I talked about, you're talking about a 2-year window to get some of these things online if you started building today. And the demand yet continues to grow more and more. So,
Well, let's move right down into where you are right now, which is at Rice University and the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute, which is part of the Alliance for Technology and Entrepreneurship. You are really addressing this in a most unique and powerful way. Give us an overview of how the Alliance is moving forward.
In terms of the sustainable technologies that we were talking about before, we've got research going on in biofuels, wind power. We're looking at wind turbine technologies, turbine blades. We're looking at offshore and onshore wind turbines themselves. We're doing the analysis and design to look at blade vibration suppression, you know, so the blades stay in sync.
Yeah, they do have to work together, don't they?
They do. Mm-hmm. And it becomes, you know, you can imagine what the conditions are like with these things facing the elements all the time. We do risk analysis on the fragility and vulnerability of the blades. And also we've got one of the first, if not the first, carbon nanotube production laboratories in the country. Dr. Richard Smalley was the one that started the institute there at Rice, and it's still going strong today. And so we're very much into nanomaterials for the turbine blade development and power conversion. So we're also looking into nanotubes for power transmission. We're doing solar research utilizing some of these nanotechnologies as well to better absorb the energy from the sun. Matter of fact, we just got an award, or maybe it was made it into the Guinness Book of World Records, of creating the darkest material ever created using nanotechnology.
By the way, I'm just curious, because everyone's throwing the term around nanotechnology, but when you talk about nanotubes for transmitting energy, that's one I'm not familiar with.
Just from my layman's understanding,
I understand.
Of the nanotube technology is that you have less line loss than the current metal technologies that we use.
Is it a metal-based, but you're just transforming it into a more efficient form?
Correct, and it holds the energy longer, as I understand, and so it makes it more efficient.
There you go. So, okay, that makes sense.
We're also very focused on something that's not very sexy like the nanotechnologies, because these have different applications, but we're looking at real good maintenance technologies in the corrosion area. We've created the Corrosion Center there at Rice University with the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, which is NACE. They're located here in Houston, and our focus for the center is on new corrosion technologies. Again, nano plays a role in that, even though it's not sexy to talk about maintaining a bridge structure or maintaining a pipeline, but corrosion takes its toll after 50 years because some of these infrastructure pieces are very, very old and are starting to fall apart on us. But the hope is, Sid, that, you know, with using something like a nano super hydrophobic technology, that not only can we arrest corrosion, but actually stop it. So we're looking at detection technologies for stress corrosion and cracking, but we're also looking at how to prevent them as well, which is, I think, is critical. If we can extend their life expectancy, you know, using these new technologies for coatings as well as cathodic protection, fighting corrosion, then hallelujah, you know, we've made another breakthrough.
What that translates directly to in the long term is fewer mountains that have to be ripped up and shredded to get to those raw materials.
Correct. I mean, and it's all a question of how can we extend the life of these things.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten to the point where there's some folks that would probably say, well, it's okay, we can, you know, we're wealthy enough or we're strong enough to replace some of those things periodically. Well, sure we are, and it's just going to cost us a lot more unless, you know, if we can prevent things from wearing out or from rusting, you know, through corrosion, then we ought to be utilizing these technologies. And now I think we're to the point after our pipeline failures and some of these bridge failures that we've seen recently, there's really a focus by our Congress and by our government, especially the state governments now are starting to come back around and saying, what can we do to not only detect but prevent these failures from happening? And that's what our focus is about with this Corrosion Technology Center at Rice.
Well, what I find fascinating about the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute at Rice and the Alliance for Technology is the fact that you're integrating so many aspects of the university and what it brings to bear in terms of research, the business, and environment. And what you're really focused on is now bringing this to market. That, to me, is the very important critical element.
The Rice Alliance for example, on bringing it to market, they have several programs every year to bring biotechnologies, information technologies, as well as energy and nano to market. They bring in the investor as well as the technology group together, the inventor. We match those up there at the Alliance. We're going to go past those four that I just mentioned and look at greenhouse gas and greenhouse capture. This is education and research coming together, and it's actually the integration of science and business. That's the best way to describe it and what we do. And we've got, over the past 5 years, we've got multiple success stories, you know, in commercialization, bringing about innovations from the laboratories, the inventors, again, to the marketplace, you know, with the investors. I think it's a very good program that we've started, and we continue to have, you know, really good success with it.
Some people see this as a cost. In reality, it's profitable.
Oh, very much so. From the sustainability side, I think that's where we're really making a big difference. Again, from the oil and gas side, you know, we do research getting in more into the oil and gas realm today, energy world, past corrosion. You know, we do research in seismology. We do research in enhanced oil recovery, flow assurance, which is you know, really critical for offshore production, so you can actually bring what you're producing to shore. We look at natural gas hydrate production and seafloor stability, which is something that I helped with when I was at the Department of Energy back in 2000. We do well logging technologies and also look at different tar sands and oil shale extraction, carbon management. We actually do work with robotics to look at autonomous robots for flexible tubing inspections on the seafloor.
See, what's interesting is that I think a lot of people don't understand that all of this is really part of sustainability. We're looking at all of the large-scale things, the solar and wind generators, but in reality, bringing these to market and all of the micro-technologies and adaptive technologies that are required is a huge part of this.
Yes, and actually here, I'd like to invite your listeners to come in if they could find a room here in Houston in the first week of May for the Offshore Technology Conference that we have. It's the largest conference that we have in Houston. We have over 60,000 people, engineers and so forth, attend.
Wow.
The conference at our Reliant Stadium. These are massive to produce oil and gas, you know, under the Gulf of Mexico, under the oceans. But globally, these companies come from all over the world, Norway, from France, from Brazil, and they have not only the state oil-owned oil companies and technology companies, but the private side comes together, and it's just a incredible show on how to more efficiently and effectively produce oil and gas. I tell you, those technologies become not only efficient, but also become very environmentally friendly if used properly, and the footprints that we leave behind now from the conventional side become smaller and smaller. And through horizontal drilling and some of the other incredible technologies that we have, we do it in harmony with the environment. And again, it just takes a focus to get us to produce better. And we're going to be dependent for a long time. It's going to be a long bridge into the future, into the sustainable, totally sustainable technologies, and we're going to be fossil-based. And I truly believe that all of these things have a relevance, and I'm never ignorant about ignoring any of the new technologies like solar or wind. Certainly we don't at Rice, but we also are very strongly supporting and helping research in the conventional areas as well, conventional oil and gas, which to me, without that, there wouldn't be the other at this particular point.
I really get your point, and I appreciate that, because I know that you are someone who is very dedicated to all of the environmental values that so many of us share, and that you're applying your greatest wisdom to do this, to deal with really the real issues that a lot of us just don't have any idea about. Emil Pena, I want to thank you, and I want to, why don't you give people information about how they can find out more about what's happening with you and the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute at Rice University?
You can go to our website, which, you know, it's www.rice.edu, and from there it launches you into our Systems Institute, and check us out from there. I've only been at Rice since October, but we're giving our website a new look and linking it more efficiently to the other areas there at Rice that help us with our institute, such as the Baker Institute, and other areas too that on this Baker Corrosion Center and all, we'll have our website up for that pretty rapidly. But for the policymakers that are listening today, can't happen without a good public policy. And so we not only are working in the science and engineering areas, which are the base for all this, but without the policy, it doesn't happen nearly fast enough.
That's part of the new technology as well.
Exactly.
Emil Pena, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sid. Have a great day.
The American miracle. Share the dream. Now, more than ever. Wishing you all a warm place to be, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.